We'll turn again to 1 Peter chapter 5. And we've come to the second half of verse 5. All of you, clothe yourselves with humility toward one another, because God opposes the proud but gives grace to the humble. Now, in this chapter, Peter has been speaking about how Christians are to relate to one another in a local church. And we've seen that in verses 1 to 4, he writes especially to the elders of the church, the leaders, the teachers, and he tells them that they must act as leaders. He tells them in verse 2 that they must be shepherds, leading and guiding the flock. They must be overseers, ruling the flock. But the important thing that Peter wants to emphasize is this. He wants to stress the way that they must do this work. He tells them in verse 3, not lording it over those entrusted to you, but being examples to the flock. These leaders must not lord it over the flock. They are not to be dictators, despots, thinking of themselves as important, doing everything for their own benefit, expecting others to serve them. If they are shepherds, they are there for the benefit of the sheep, not the other way round. They are there to serve the flock. They are there to feed and guard and care for and love the people of God. In short, all their work is to be done in the spirit of humility. Yes, they must exercise authority because God has called them to do so. But they must do it humbly, thinking about what is best for others, not what is best for themselves. So that is Peter's word to the leaders of the church. And then in verse 5, Peter turns from speaking to the leaders, the elders, and speaks to the youngers. The NIV has young men at the beginning of verse 5. But in the original Greek it just says youngers, younger people. If the elders are the people who lead and teach the church, then Peter uses the word youngers to mean the people who are led and taught by the elders. That's to say, the other members of the church. And what is Peter's word to them? Youngers, he says, in the same way, be submissive to those who are older. And again, that last phrase is just the same as the word in verse 1, elders. Be submissive to the elders. If the elders are there to lead, then the youngers must be willing to submit to their leadership. They must be prepared to learn from their teaching and follow their example and submit to their decisions. So again, what is needed is humility. It takes humility to submit to other people. It takes humility to say, well, I don't really understand why these leaders have made that decision, but I don't need to. That's why they're leaders. It takes humility to sit and listen and learn, especially when the person who's speaking is saying something you don't really want to hear. It takes humility to accept a warning or a rebuke from someone else. It takes humility to be a follower, especially if you're used to being a leader in other spheres of life. I want you to think for a moment about how hard it must have been for some members, especially of these churches, to be submissive to the elders, the leaders. Imagine some wealthy man. He's a senator, maybe. Or he's a magistrate. Or he's a businessman. He's got a household of servants. Or as he'd call them, slaves. This man is used to being in control in every sphere in which he moves. He's used to having his own way, to giving orders. And that man becomes a Christian. He becomes a member of one of these churches to which Peter is writing. And suddenly, he finds that within the church, he's a nobody. He's a novice. And worse still, he finds that the leaders of the church are people he would once have thought of as nobodies. They're very ordinary people. Some of them maybe have had very little education. Some of them are poor working men. Some of them may even be slaves. And this man, who is so used to being the man in charge, the man whom everybody listens to, the man whose opinion is so important, this man has got to accept that there in the church, he's a younger, he's a junior, he's a listener, he's a learner, he's someone whose job it is to follow, someone who must be submissive to these nobodies. It would have been so hard for a man like that to learn this lesson, to be submissive. And it's still hard for people like that who are converted. A company manager, a university lecturer, a wealthy businessman is converted. Well, he's used to giving orders, to expressing his own opinions, to having things done his way. But here in the church, says Peter, he has to be submissive. And it's hard. It takes humility. It takes humbleness. But that's what Peter commands. That each of these church members to whom he's writing, whatever their social or educational background, each one of them must be prepared to say, here in the church, my role is to be submissive to those whom God raises up as leaders. So the leaders of the church must do their work in a spirit of humbleness. And each church member must fulfill his or her role in the same spirit of humbleness. That is why Peter uses the phrase in verse 5, in the same way. The same principle must apply to both. And then Peter, in this second half of verse 5, sums up what he's been saying. So, all of you, clothe yourselves with humility towards one another. Leaders and followers, teachers and learners, old and young, seniors and juniors, experienced Christians and new Christians, he says, all of you must clothe yourselves with humility toward one another. Now, the word that Peter uses here is a very interesting word. You see, in the NIV, it's translated, clothe yourselves with humility. Literally, tie humility round yourselves. It's a word that would be used, for example, to tie an apron round yourself. And it's a very odd and unexpected word for Peter to be using here. But surely there is a reason why Peter uses this word. There's a reason why he talks about tying humility on like an apron. Peter is thinking about an incident that happened many years earlier. An incident that Peter will never forget. He's thinking about the last evening he spent with the Lord Jesus Christ before the crucifixion. You remember, Peter and the other disciples gather in an upstairs room to eat a last meal with the Lord Jesus Christ, a Passover meal. And Peter and the other disciples take their places around the supper table. Now, all of those men had had a long, hard, exhausting day. They had all been on their feet all day, and they were hot and dusty, and their feet were burning. And in that society, it was traditional that before you sat down to a meal, a slave would bring in a bowl of water, and he'd kneel down before each of the guests in turn, and he would unfasten their sandals, and he'd wash the dust off their feet. If there were no slave in the house, it would be done by the youngest member of the family, the least important person in the household. So the question that night was this: who was going to do the slave's work? Who was going to do the menial task, the degrading job? Who was going to kneel down in front of the others and wash the dust off their feet? And none of the disciples round that table moved. Why should they? You can imagine what each one of them was saying to himself. Well, why should it be me? I've worked harder than any of them today. Do they really expect me to start waiting on them now? Why has it always got to be me that finishes up doing the dirty jobs? Why am I always taken for granted? And why can't someone else wait on me for a change? Each one of them could say, I'm too tired. It's not me that should be doing it. It's not my job. Why should I be viewed as the junior partner? Each of them had their own justifications for sitting there. But the real problem for each one of them in the end was simply this: that each one of them was too proud to do it. You see, it simply comes down to that in the end. It comes down to submission, service, seeing other people as more important than yourself. None of these men wanted to give in. They all wanted to be important. They all wanted others to fuss over them. They wanted other people to pay attention to them and to notice their needs and to give them the recognition they deserved. They each wanted to have their own way. And so not one of those men moved. And then the Lord Jesus rose to his feet. And we read this. The story is told in John's Gospel. In chapter 13, Jesus knew that the Father had put all things under his power, that he had come from God, that he was returning to God. So he got up from the meal. He took off his outer clothing and he tied a towel round his waist. He stripped off the garment that marked him out as one of the guests, and he tied round himself another garment, a garment that marked him out as a servant, as a slave, as someone whose job it was to submit to others and to serve others. And then we read, after that he poured water into a basin and began to wash his disciples' feet, drying them with the towel that was tied around him. Jesus Christ was and is the Lord of glory. He had come from God, and he would return to God. He had ruled the universe since the moment of its creation, and he would soon be returning to the throne of the universe to receive the homage of angels and archangels. Jesus Christ was the Lord of Lords, creator of all the galaxies, emperor of a billion worlds, ruler of angels. He is God, without beginning, without ending. He is the source of all beauty and majesty. He is infinite in power and holiness. He is the one who has the right to rule, subdue, and use all creatures as he wills. He made them all. He sustains them all. Men, angels, and beasts exist for him. He is the King of Kings. He is the Lord of Lords. And he knew it. And this Jesus, who had come from God and was going to God, this Jesus put on the uniform of a slave. And this Jesus kneels down in front of each of these men. He kneels down in front of these sinful men, and tenderly, gently, he washes the sweat and the dust off their feet, and then he dries them with the towel. Why should he? He's the Lord, and they're his servants. Why should he be serving them? He's more weary than any of them. If they think they've been working hard through the day, not one of them has expended 1/100th of the energy that he has poured out. And he's got greater work ahead of him than any of them can imagine. There's the work of Calvary still to do. There's the work of carrying the sin of the world on his own shoulders. There's the work of redeeming a universe. There's the work of bearing the Father's wrath and breaking the power of evil. Surely, if ever a man was entitled to rest and to be waited on by others, the Lord Jesus is entitled to say, "Now I can rest." But no, what we see there in that upper room is this, that the Lord Jesus is not thinking about his own rights. He's not thinking about his own dignity. He's not thinking about his own position. He's not thinking about his weariness. He's thinking about these 12 weary men whom he has taken under his care. He's thinking about them, and he's thinking about the hard day that they've had, and he's thinking about the temptations that they're going to face in the next hours, and he's thinking about their burning feet, and he's thinking about their struggles. And so the Lord of glory forgets about himself, and he's the one who submits. He's the one who kneels. Spend 1,000,000 years thinking about that, and you will never get to the end of the wonder of it. The Lord of glory kneeling down at the feet of sinners. John says, having loved his own, he loved them to the end. He loved them without reservation. He loved them to absurd lengths. He loved them to the point where his love for them drove out all his own concerns, all his own needs. His love for them forced him to forget his own dignity in order that he should serve them. And that is what we mean when we talk about humility. That is what Peter means when he talks about tying on humility. As we said last week, humility doesn't mean having a low view of your own abilities, though many people have that confusion in their mind. Humility means not thinking about yourself. Humility means treating others as if they were more important than you. Humility means being willing to do menial jobs for the benefit of others. It means thinking always of other people and their needs and their feelings and what is best for them. That was the humility that the Lord Jesus tied around him. That was the attitude with which he clothed himself. It was that attitude that brought him down from the throne of heaven to a dirty stable. It was that attitude that made him trudge the roads of Galilee for 3 long years with nowhere to lay his head. It was that attitude that brought him to the cross, where he gave his infinitely precious life for worthless sinners. And it was that attitude of humility that made him kneel in front of these 12 men. And the Lord Jesus said this to those 12 men. When he'd finished washing their feet, he put on his clothes, he returned to his place. "Do you understand what I've done for you?" he asked them. "You call me teacher and Lord, and rightly so, for that's what I am. Now that I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also should wash one another's feet. I have set you an example that you should do as I have done for you." You know, sometimes we excuse our lack of humble service by saying, "Well, if I start kneeling down, if I start serving others, if I start treating others as more important than myself, then they'll only take advantage of it. It'll only encourage them to be selfish." Well, all we can say is that that did not prevent the Lord Jesus from taking the position of humility in front of his disciples. He believed that the best way to teach them humility was to practice humility, to set them this example. And look what it did to Peter. Did it make Peter vain when he saw the Lord of glory kneeling at his feet? What did it do to that proud man, Peter, who had been so concerned about his own dignity and position? It broke his heart. 30 years later, Peter is still remembering, and Peter is still seeing in his mind's eye the Lord of glory kneeling before him. And Peter is never going to forget that. And Peter is still preaching to others what he learned in that upstairs room. And he's still saying to them, "All of you, tie humility round yourself. All of you, follow that example of the Lord Jesus who humbled himself." So that is relevant to the whole church. Every Christian must see himself or herself in that way. Every one of us must be reminding ourselves daily of the Lord Christ who kneels before his people and takes the menial role and humiliates himself and washes their feet. And every one of us must be ready to follow the example of the Lord Jesus Christ in this. Now, this is so utterly different from the natural inclination of fallen, sinful human beings. The constant tendency of the human heart is to ask in every situation, "Well, what's best for me? What will I get out of it?" We call that attitude selfishness. But we could equally well call that attitude pride. The belief that I am the center of the universe. That what matters most is my fulfillment, my feelings, my needs, my opinions. A Christian man says, "I don't think I'll bother to go to church tonight. I'm too tired, and I wouldn't get anything out of it." Is that really all we go to church for? To get something out of it for ourselves? Doesn't it matter whether God is honoured publicly? Doesn't it matter whether you encourage or discourage others by your absence or presence? You see, that man's attitude is selfishness, but it's also pride. The way this man takes for granted that the reason the meeting is being held is for his benefit. And if he doesn't think he's going to get any benefit, he may as well stay away. A Christian woman is going through a hard time. She's got problems and she's got hurts to cope with. And she expects everyone to notice and to be sympathetic and to make allowances for her and to rally round her and to pray for her. And this woman never notices that other people have problems just as big, just as painful as she has. She never thinks about praying for them. After all, it's all she can do to keep going praying for herself. She never thinks of asking how they're doing. After all, she knows that no one in the world is having a hard time as she is. And she expects everyone else to make allowances for her when she's exhausted or irritable. But she never thinks she ought to make allowances for anyone else when they're stretched to the limit, because she doesn't notice. Well, again, that's just self-centeredness. And self-centeredness is another word for pride. This woman is absorbed in herself. This woman is absorbed in her feelings, her needs, and she knows that they are supremely important. Now, do you see how subtle a thing pride is? And how pride can disguise itself. When we use the word proud in English, we've been conditioned to think that the proud person is always some haughty-faced aristocrat, a tyrant, a despot, a Mussolini, a Caesar. Well, pride may show itself that way in haughtiness and arrogance. But pride is not always like that. This man we've pictured may well not be arrogant at all in that way. He may be the sort of man who says all the time, "Oh, I know I'm a failure. I know I'm useless." The woman we've described may not be haughty and self-confident. She may be someone who's always ready to talk about her weaknesses and her needs and how vulnerable she is. But for both of them, the point is still that each sees himself or herself as the centre of the universe. Each is still saying, "My needs, my feelings, my problems, my struggles, my tiredness matters more than anyone else's." You see, self-pity is as much a form of pride as self-confidence. The self-pitying person is a person who's thinking all the time about themselves, as much as the self-confident person. So humility means forcing your thoughts away from yourself, forcing your thoughts away from your feelings, and asking instead, well, what is he feeling? What is she feeling? It means forcing yourself to stop repeating your opinions and actually to start listening to other people's opinions. Someone else, you know, might have an opinion worth listening to. Humility means being quiet about the topics of conversation you find so fascinating and encouraging other people instead to talk about the things they may enjoy talking about. Humility means thinking and acting on the basis that other people are more important than yourself. Asking yourself in every situation, not what can I get out of it, but what can I do for them in this situation? How can I serve them? How can I encourage them? I'm here for them, not they are here for me. True humility says other people are more important than yourself. Now, as we said last week, true humility towards others can only begin when you learn humility towards God. Peter is going to go on and develop that thought in verse 6, where he says, humble yourselves under God's mighty hand. He's been encouraging them to be humble towards one another, but he says that can only happen when you humble yourself under the hand of God, that mighty hand. You see, the problem is this. The fallen human heart does not only believe that we are more important than other people. The fallen human being does not only say within himself, I am more important than other human beings. In his heart of hearts, every sinner believes, I am more important than God. I and my feelings and my wishes, I am the center of everything. If God exists, he exists for my benefit. It's his job to make me happy. It's his job to supply my needs. It's his job to be there to sort out my problems. And if I do anything for God, if I pray, if I go to church, well, I'm doing God a favor, aren't I? Because I'm giving him a little of my valuable time and attention. He is there to give me all his time and attention. And I'm doing him a great favor if I give him a little of mine in return. That is how twisted and distorted the human mind is. We imagine that God is there for our benefit. And we forget that he made us for his own glory. We think that our opinion of God and what God does is so crucial. And we forget that what really matters is God's opinion of us. We talk as if we can judge God. And we forget that it's us who's in the dock, not him. And we forget that every second of time we live is doled out to us by God's provision. You are alive this morning. For some of you, that is a miracle because you have walked very close to the gates of death. And the fact that there is breath in your mouth this morning, the fact that there is a heartbeat, is only because God has spared you another year, another month, another day. And yet you talk as if your body is yours to do what you want. And your life is your own. You see, that is where pride starts. That is the root of pride. A wrong view of ourselves in relation to God. And when a person becomes a Christian, that is the very first thing that changes. You begin to see that God, the eternal, the infinite, the one who created and upholds all things, you begin to see that God is supremely important and that you are only a speck of dust before him. Your opinions, what do they matter when you're standing before the eternal and all-knowing God? Your abilities, how much are they really worth when you see yourself in the light of God's greatness? Do you not know? Have you not heard? Has it not been told you from the beginning? Have you not understood? Since the earth was founded, he sits enthroned above the circle of the earth, and its people are like grasshoppers. He stretches out the heavens like a canopy. He spreads them out like a tent to live in. He brings princes to naught. He reduces the rulers of this world to nothing. They take root in the ground, and then he blows on them, and they wither, and they are gone. See God. see God in His greatness, His majesty, His glory, His supreme goodness, and all your self-importance, all your self-will, all your certainty that you're the center of the universe, all your self-pity, it will all shrivel away, and you'll begin to feel that you're a grasshopper. You'll begin to feel that you're so high. Indeed, as you bow before God, as you realize His immensity, you will begin simply to forget yourself. You won't think of yourself as a grasshopper. You'll think of yourself as nothing. You know, does a man stand at the foot of Mount Everest and look up to that peak that's lost in the clouds and then begin to work out exactly how high he is compared with the mountain? No, he's just overwhelmed. He simply forgets himself in the greatness of that towering mount. And as you begin to look at the God of the Bible, that will be the effect upon you. The more you look at Him, the less your little triumphs or failures, the less your feelings and opinions and wishes will seem to matter. And you'll find yourself saying, all that matters is God. All that matters is that I should please Him. All that matters is that I should honor Him. All that matters is that I should listen to Him and learn from Him and be allowed to worship Him. Once you thought that you were doing God a favor if you worshipped Him, but now you'll begin to ask, will God really allow me to worship Him? That is the beginning of real Christian conversion. That is the foundation of all true religion. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And as that great change in your thinking occurs, as you begin to view yourself rightly in relation to God, then you'll begin to see yourself rightly in relation to other people. Christianity isn't first and foremost about treating other people rightly. Christianity is first and foremost about taking your right place in relation to God. But when you take your right place in relation to God, then you'll begin to take your right place in relation to other people. When a man or a woman has been humbled by looking at God, then that humility will show itself in your relationships with other people. We're drawing towards a close. I've rambled a bit this morning. I usually try to make sure there are some headings and subheadings to help you follow. Let's summarize what we've said this morning under three headings. The first truth we've thought about is this, that God commands every believer to humble himself. Consciously, deliberately, you must tie on humility. God commands you to take the position of a slave, a servant towards others. God commands you to forget about yourself and your interests and your concerns and to turn your heart outwards towards others. God commands you to humble yourself. That is the first truth. And then the second truth we thought about is this, that this humility is modeled upon the Lord Jesus, and it can only come to us through the Lord Jesus. He sets the example of humble, self-forgetting service. He stands before us to show us what it means to be truly humble. And then as we see our pride, And as we call upon the Lord Jesus for mercy, it is He who comes and lives within us to change us from within and to work out His own humility within us. And then the third truth we thought about is this, that true humility towards other men and other women can only begin when we see God and when we humble ourselves before God. And then finally, let me remind you of one last truth that's taught here in these verses. It is this, that God promises great blessings to the humble, and God gives fearful warnings to the proud. We'll be developing that thought next week, God willing. But just look what's said at the end of verse 5. God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. How seriously does God view pride? Whether it shows itself in haughtiness and arrogance, or whether it shows itself in self-pity and selfishness, whether it shows itself by a demanding, greedy attitude, how seriously does God view pride in a Christian? How does God view human pride? The answer is, He hates it. And God says, I oppose the proud. I stand against them. I'm determined to block them and to frustrate them and to thwart them and in the end to punish them. The proud man has God as his enemy. Now, those of you who call yourselves Christians here this morning, remember that. That when you take a proud attitude towards other men and women, God promises to stand against you. He'll thwart your plans. He'll blight your hopes. He'll take your satisfactions away from you. He will wreck your life if he has to, in order to humble you in your pride. You put yourself in the center. You think of Christian life and life in the church as simply a way of finding fulfillment for yourself and getting what you want. If you think and if you act in that self-centered way, you will have God against you. And I tell you, your life will be a life blighted and disappointed and spoiled. God says it. He opposes the proud. But what about those of you who are not Christians, who do not pretend to be Christians this morning? Well, you are by definition proud, because you refuse to submit to God. You believe that you can carry on living for yourself year after year, making yourself the center of everything, following your own opinions, trusting your own judgments, fulfilling your own desires. Isn't that the ultimate pride? That you who were born yesterday and who will perish tomorrow, you who were created in a way that you don't understand, and whose life will be cut short in a way that you can't predict, you who can't run your own life or control your own feelings, you who can't live for 14 days without food or 48 hours without drink, you dare to think that you can ignore God and live without God? What utter and blasphemous pride that is! And God opposes the proud. The man or woman who thinks and lives in that way will have God as an enemy. You will have God as your enemy in this life, and you will have God as your enemy for all eternity. God opposes the proud. They are not my words, they are the words of the Bible. But blessed be God. God also gives grace to the humble. And wherever you have men and women and children who know that they are small and who know that they are grasshoppers and who know that they are helpless and who know that the universe does not center around them and who know that God is supremely important. And wherever you have men and women who are willing to confess sin and to bow before God, then God is ready to give grace. God is ready to give infinite mercy to those men and women. God dwells in light unapproachable. God inhabits eternity. And yet he dwells also with those who are of humble spirit and contrite mind. So say the scriptures. Our God has arms wide open to receive humble, needy, helpless sinners. Humble yourselves, therefore, under God's mighty hand, that he may lift you up in due time. May God speak to our hearts from his holy and infallible word.